This episode of Cider Chat was produced with the support of the following Finger Lakes Cider Producers of New York State: Bellwether, Hard Cider and Wine. You can listen to Bill Barton of Bellwether on episode 199. That cidery has been open in the Finger Lakes region since 1997. And Black Diamond Cider was featured in episode 201, where you could hear Ewan Merwin, a retired pomologist from Cornell University, talk apples, nitrogen, nutrients, and more in that episode 201. And Eric Schatt of Redbird Cider was featured in episode 202. Eric is a research farm manager at Cornell, and also, along with his wife, Deva Mass, at their biodynamic orchard, making cider and offering grafts of new cider varieties, such as the Gnarly Chapman. And the Finger Lakes Cider House, that has a cider brand known as Kite and String, was just featured in episode 203, where I spoke with owner Garrett Miller on the business of cider. And South Hill Cider, the featured conversation in this week's episode 204. A big tip of the glass to all these cideries for making it possible for me to visit the Finger Lakes region in the fall of 2019 and visit Ithaca for creating all those visits to bring these conversations to you. Now, let's get on with this episode 204.
Hello, this is Steve Seelan from South Hill Cider, located in Ithaca, New York, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. This week's feature chat, as you heard, is Steve Seelan, and he's going to be sharing a bit about the history of his first beginnings into cider, which actually stem back to his dad, which I thought was really interesting. And there is talk about a cider cave somewhere around Buffalo, New York. I love that kind of stuff. And also working with barrels and more. So stay tuned for that chat. That'll be coming up. But first, a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. There is something about this time of year that kind of feels like the apples are in time, where everything gets a little bit busy, even though, at least in the northern hemisphere, it's a bit dark out. I am waiting for December 21st, winter solstice, when the light returns. But in the meanwhile, in my spot of Ciderville, I'm dealing with lots of snow, heavy rain, and before I was producing this podcast this morning, I was out on the roof shoveling it. Oh boy, who wants to do that stuff? But you know, you just gotta do what you gotta do. And that's kind of, I think, partly why I enjoy speaking to you so much, because I know Ciderville is a lot like me. We just kind of are kind of gritty people. We kind of get down and do what needs to be done, certainly with cider, because last night I was up way into I think it was like 2 a.m, racking over my cider that I made this year, all those golden hornets that I picked up on my way back from the Finger Lakes when I was visiting Steve, who's going to be on the chat this week shortly, and all the other cider makers in the Finger Lakes region. I had to rack that over, and then I had to mix up the barrel because I'm doing batonnage. And when you have an oak barrel, you always have to kind of top it off. And then just cleaning carboys and moving stuff around. I have about, well, the barrel's 25 gallons. I have about like 40, 50 gallons of cider in different size vessels, you know, a lot of 5-gallon carboys, a couple 1-gallon carboys, making my classic cider that I love to just share with people, because there's so many people that I meet who are just having cider for the first time. And I've found over the years that for brand new folks to cider, or folks who had past experiences, I really like to make that sizer, which is a minimal amount of honey added right at the start of fermentation. And then I use a sweet mead yeast. So for example, for 5 gallons of juice, I add maybe 2.5 pounds of honey and then the liquid yeast. So I made 10 gallons of that this year because I run out of it every year. Everybody wants it and I like to age it. I have the option for doing long aging because I'm not a commercial maker. So I like to age it for a minimum of a year. And it's just a delicious cider to share with newbies to cider. And also, shoot, I brought it to the Ross Cider Fest in the UK and was able to pass that around. And it just made me so cheery to be able to share something that really is super easy to make and always comes out rock solid. So I highly recommend that if you are one of those folks who is contacting me, and a lot of people do contact me saying, oh, I'm having a hard time making my cider, what to do? I always recommend make a sizer. It's primarily cider with just a little bit of honey, and that particular yeast works really well. It's just a sweet mead liquid yeast. You could get it from any of the brands that produce yeast out there. Just call your local cider shop or go online and find it. So I did all that last night, getting everything cleaned up because this week I'm getting out of this mess and I'm heading to California and bringing Mama back for the winter, which is going to free me up in a lot of ways. And it's kind of a bittersweet because my mom is getting up there and we never know if she's going to return. And I'm sure some of you could relate to that. But I get to see my family while I'm out there. And Jay is the guitar and person and singer, my dear cousin, and I are going to be going into a recording studio this Friday. So this podcast comes out on Wednesday. We go in on Friday and we're going to be recording the We Like Cider song, trying to get a really good cut. So I'm super stoked about that. Going to go up in the hills of Santa Cruz, get down in a little studio, probably bring some cider to drink. And it's my first time ever going into a recording studio. So I'm super wowed. And I know Steve, who is the cider maker and owner of South Hill Cider, he's a professional musician. I'm sure he's been in the recording studio a lot, knows all about it. Certainly knows about acoustics and whatnot. But to me, I'm a newbie to it. And I'm just super stoked to do that with my cousin. So I absolutely adore him and love singing with him. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a short trip out. And then the next time I return to California will be in January for CiderCon 2020. And so this is your reminder now, if you are kind of hemming and hawing, I can't go, should I go, shouldn't I go? I'm just going to say you should go. Whether you're a commercial maker or a cider enthusiast, there is a lot to gain by going to CiderCon. For one thing, it's in a warm place this year. It's going to be in Oakland, which is a really happening town. We're going to have some episodes coming up with that. And I was there earlier kind of doing a recon so I could talk about it in future episodes and saw the location where the actual conference is going to take place. It's in a large, you know, typical hotel, the Marriott, and you need to make your reservations now for the Marriott because that could sell out, and that's a bummer. I'll tell you why, because the traffic in California is like no other. And I'm basically like kind of a country hick, if you will, living on a dirt road, you know, in the way back. So when you go into California, it's like stop and go. So if you're thinking like, oh, I'll do an Airbnb or, you know, maybe you'll save some money there. But you won't save time at all. It's hard to get around. Let's say you like go to Alameda, which is right next to Oakland, and it's a little kind of like island. It's really cool, you know, it's accessible, it's like a stone's throw, but getting on and off of it, it's rough. I mean, you just want to be there because that's where the conversation's happening, that's where the network happens, and it could get sold out, so make your reservations now. They have a pretty rock solid rate, keeping it low for everybody. And it's a good time to just put it out in, like, I don't know, your Facebook group or something like that, your association, say, who wants a room with me? I did that last year with Erica, who is just the happy camper out there in Ciderville. And we had a fantastic time sharing a room together. It was really, really cool. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't gone to CiderCon. So that's happening. And also the tours are going to be happening too. So you want to sign up for some of these things, tours and also tastings that happen during CiderCon do it now because these things sell out. And there's some awesome tours. There's like a food and cider pairing one. There's a half-day tour for those of you who are maybe coming in super late and want to go on the tour, but you don't think like going at 8 o'clock in the morning is doable for you. Well, this year there's one tour that's going to be later on in the afternoon. And then there's three other tours heading out to parts unknown. Not really. I know exactly where I'm going because I'm leading one of those tours to the Parajo Valley that's down into like the Santa Cruz County and into San Jose to stop at Cider Junction. We're going to be out in the orchard with some good folks, Tanuki, Serventi, Five Mile Orchard, Santa Cruz Cider Company, bringing you to a spot of Ciderville that I absolutely adore. So that is my plug. Get on with it. I'm heading out to California this Friday, stoked and stoked to return in January and see you at CiderCon. That's going to be tons of fun. All right, I'm going to take a little pause here and I'll be right back. Yes, there is a reason why we do it like this. It's because we like cider and we do it any way we freaking want to, don't we? God, I'm a little, I'm running into it today. Oh, Lord. It's kind of the way I feel. Hey, when you've been up till 2 in the morning, and I know some of you have, dealing with your cider and kind of loving it up, you know, you get a little punchy the next day. What can I say? It's Monday. It's snowing outside. Anyways, we like cider, and that is the reason why we do it like this. And there's a lot of ways to drink it, a lot of ways to enjoy it. And that's that from that little catchy tune, We Like Cider, that I was talking about. And if you like cider and you want to kind of showcase that, well, there's some cider swag available at the Cider Chat Cider Swag store at TeePublic. Just Google that. That's TeePublic. Get your orders in right now. They have like a sale price. They're always having sale prices. I think now it's like 30% off. So like a t-shirt's like $14. That's a great gift for yourself, or maybe you let people know, hey, I want that. I'd like to like have some cider swag. Check it out. There's like 8 designs right now up there. There's going to be some more rolling out. I'm having a lot of fun doing that, and it's a great way to support the podcast too. So check it out, the Cider Chat Swag Store. There'll be a link in the show notes to this here episode, or just Google it at TeePublic Cider Chat.
Walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
It's time now to go to our featured conversation with Steve Seelin of South Hill Cider. He is based on the South Hill, just outside of Ithaca. It's the south end of Cayuga Lake. Steve's been in this area for a while. He'll be telling you about that, but I just want to tell you a little bit about the tasting room. I arrived a few days earlier, and the first night I was in the Finger Lakes region, I went over to South Hill Cider, and there was an event. Steve was playing with the band that he's in called Rose and the Bros. He plays both the fiddle and guitar, and they were cranking it, playing Zydeco music. It was a really, really nice scene, an outdoor fire, picnic tables, the whole nine yards, and of course, a ton of cider to be had, including some gumbo. So if you've been to New Orleans, you know what gumbo is like. It was a really nice scene. And what I was particularly impressed about was he was playing underneath, well, the whole band was, and folks are hanging out underneath this really huge outdoor scene with a high ceiling. And normally when you are in something like that and there's music, the sound bounces all over the place. But this is part of who Steve is. I think he approaches probably everything in his life the same way, with a certain aesthetic and a certain quality and essence, and it certainly resounds quite loudly in his cider. He designed the building so that the ceiling, and take note of this if you are going to be opening something similar or have problem with sound bouncing, the ceiling has little holes, like, you know, a zillion little holes, perforated holes, and that allowed the sound to go up through the holes and not bounce back at people. So it got absorbed a bit. Thus, the acoustics were fantastic, and it just provides a really nice, almost, I could say, eloquent space to be enjoying cider. And then you walk in through these glass doors, and you're in this spacious tasting room with all the South Hill ciders on display, a large bar set up, really neat scene. And in the back, it's a production area. This is a brand new building. On the outside, it's corrugated steel that's just kind of like rusting and has a certain patina. I love that style. It's exactly what I want to do in my house. So keep the flying squirrels off of it. I think we'll be able to hold on to the steel. It's really a nice look. Check out some of the photos that I have on the show notes to this here episode 204. So let's grab a glass and head to this chat with Steve Seelan of South Hill Cider as we find out a bit about his history first with cider making in New York State.
Yeah, I grew up in Western New York, so about 2.5 hours west of here. But then I moved to the Finger Lakes when I was 18, so I've been here for over half my life. It didn't even occur to me until I'd been making cider for years that growing up, my father used to visit a cider cellar. And so growing up, every Tuesday night, or almost every Tuesday night, my dad would not be home, and my brother and I would just goof off with my mom. And it was because dad was at the cider cellar. And I never really thought about what it was. I mean, I knew he went, it was a place he went and hung out with friends and they drank cider. And it turns out outside of Buffalo, there was a farm that had a cheese cave in a barn cellar in the 1800s. There was a cheese company. I can't remember the name. It might come to me. Hasselbeck, I think. Hasselbeck cheese. And what I'd heard in the 1800s, I don't know if it was German immigrants. There was some immigrants that they would take and help them get set up with cheese caves. So they would be making cheese outside of the city of Buffalo in caves before refrigeration. And then eventually when refrigeration came about, those cheese caves moved into refrigerators within the city of Buffalo. So this prior cheese cave became a cider cave. Two brothers bought the farm. They farmed it together. They lived together. They made a lot of cider. And it just got to be a community event where every Tuesday, a bunch of probably mostly guys got together in the cellar and just drank a bunch of cider, listened to music, maybe played music. Mm-hmm. A lot of those details are just like lost on the wind. But I always knew my dad was going to the cider cellar. I never got to visit there. I never got to. Barney and Bill were the two farmers' names. Barney and Bill Fuff. And I would love to track this place down and go and see this place because the cellar's still probably there.
Probably there.
But I never visited there. I never even tasted the cider. But I just always knew, oh, the cider cellar. Like, cider is something that adults do. And so a decade went by or more. I didn't even think about it. And then once I started making cider, when I moved to the Finger Lakes, I started making cider because that's what a bunch of my friends were doing. They, well, you know, would forage apples in the fall, press apples together. There'd be pressing parties, picking parties, and just started making it like that as a hobby.
Were you fermenting beforehand?
I made some beer. I don't know if I'd fermented much else.
Did you like cooking? Yeah, I mean,
I've always been into cooking. Yeah, even in high school, all college. So yeah.
So those
interesting
first
connection.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's interesting to see how these threads connect us, and something like a cider cellar, that's cool, and that's a really neat memory, and also because I'm seeing in this area, the word cellar comes up on a lot of businesses. There's like the cellar cottages or something like that we drove by.
The cellar doors.
Cellar
great
door.
Wine shop,
yeah,
cider
a great
shop
in Ithaca. Yeah, and. I'm curious, on those ciders that you were making with your friends, do you have any memories of it? Were you like pitching yeast back then, like cultured yeast?
That's how we started for sure. But then pretty soon I started experimenting with
different
wild
things.
Fermentations. Yeah. Not inoculating stuff.
Because a lot of people's early memories of making cider are not always super happy in terms of the end product.
Right.
But I have a sense that That must have been a good start.
After a while, I just started making more and more cider because I'm a musician, and so I would take it to parties, to festivals. Got really used to introducing people to cider just because that's what I had. It wasn't a goal, but I would take cider to festivals, often put it in kegs, and people over and over would just be blown away. They'd be like, what is this? This is like champagne. You know, nobody had had anything like it. And so I started making more and more, and got to the point where I was making about 4 barrels a year in my basement. And
that's sizable.
Yeah, and that's the legal limit is 200 gallons a year is what.
Thank you, Jimmy Carter.
Person. Oh, is that where it comes from?
Jimmy Carter, like, yeah, kind of legalized all, like, homebrewing back in 1979 because he had his brother Billy, who had Billy's Beer, and kind of, yeah, made it actually legal for us as non-commercial makers to do that.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Yep, so I was doing that, and that was at the same time I was working in a lot of winery tasting rooms as a musician. I was playing every week in a couple different wineries, so I was starting to drink a lot of wine, getting to know winemakers, and that definitely informed my palate a ton because that's all we were drinking. And then one of the winemakers in particular was super interested in cider, and so we started blind tasting a bunch of ciders together. We would both show up at each other's house with bottles and brown bags that we bought from wherever we could find it, sit down, blind taste, talk about it. And more often than not, actually, the ciders were pretty bad. Every now and then, we'd get a good one, and it would be like, dang, that's a really good cider. And quite often, some of those good ones were Eve's, because that was one of the only really quality commercial ciders we could reliably get around here. And then we realized that the cider we were making was as good or better than almost anything we could buy. But it's mainly because the apples we were using were great. It was a happy accident that by foraging wild and abandoned trees, we didn't even have to hunt them down. My next door neighbor has an orchard that's just a, you know, sort of a forgotten old farm orchard.
Right.
He's in a farmhouse that was built in the early 1800s, and there's probably 10 trees there that are standards. There's definitely some Grimes Golden, probably some Stamen. And then there's one that's some kind of cider apple. It's definitely a bitter, sharp cider apple.
Wow.
I don't know if it was something that was an accident or he grafted.
Yeah.
So we're just... And then wild trees. We've got some on the property here, and we're just surrounded. We hardly had to go looking for them.
Do you do a lot of foraging now still? Is that something that you're doing, or that, you know, friends like Karen who just bought by those quinces?
Right. Yeah. No, I do. We still forage wild apples from several places. And now it's nice. The word's gotten out that I actually will pay for these little wild apples. So I've had a couple locals from, you know, pretty out in the country come in with small truckloads of apples, saying, oh yeah, my neighbor told me you're buying apples. And so I actually take the time to educate these guys. I have a refractometer and iodine, so I usually always sit down with these guys and I show them how to taste apples and how to evaluate whether they're ripe or not, because that's the most important thing if you're working with any fruit, is to know that it's living up to its potential and that it has flavor in it. And trying to teach people what that means is kind of difficult. It can be sort of subjective.
Absolutely.
But when you can show people with a refractometer and iodine and then have them taste it, they can learn pretty quick.
Well, let's talk about what the iodine's doing for folks who really know nothing about the technical aspect of what we're doing. If you could just, those two like parts of the instrument, how are you using that?
Yeah, so if you're listening to this, I would say do a quick Google search and search for the Cornell Starch Iodine Ripeness Test. And so you'll probably be able to find this image that I'm talking about. And what it is it's an image that shows how much starch is in an apple. And the way you can test that is you cut the apple in half so you can see the star cross section. And then you take some iodine and put it on a plate and set the apple on the plate so that the iodine soaks the cut flesh, and then turn it right side up and wait a few minutes, and any starch that's left in the apple will turn blue or purplish, and that if you have that table from the Cornell starch test that you can find online, it can show you how ripe that apple is, basically. So if there's no starch left in the apple, it's fully ripe. And if it turns totally blue, it's totally unripe. If you do it to a potato, it'll just turn straight blue. Mm-hmm. And that would be unripe because eventually all the starches turn to sugar. And so that's one of the main measures to check for ripeness. And then the other one, you can use a refractometer that will tell you how much sugar or how many dissolved solids are in the juice. But that doesn't necessarily tell you if the apple's ripe, because some apples never truly get very ripe. If they're growing on the inside of the tree and they never get any sunlight, or if it's shaded by some big hardwood tree, even if that apple has no starch in it, it might be useless for cider making because it hasn't developed the sugars and acids that it needs to taste good. So you have to use both those tools to know that you have bricks that are up at a certain level and that your starch is pretty much gone.
Besides that early days of like hanging with your friends and making cider, did you go to school for cider making? Is this just self-taught?
It's a combination. I don't even use the word self-taught. I didn't like go to school for enology or anything. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of winemakers in this area who are very generous, and some of them are friends of mine that I've known through music or other avenues. And so most of my learning, I would say, has been directly from these winemakers. I mean, any time that I'd had issues or questions or concerns, all I have to do is take a sample to these guys or call them on the phone or bring a bottle over.
Yeah.
And so probably most of the learning I've done is directly from other
Any books
producers.
That you kind of use as a touchstone there?
When I first started at the very beginning, I would say one of the Andrew Lee books,
yeah,
I thought was very helpful. And then, at various times you use very different points of view. There's one that I would highly recommend. Randall Graham wrote Been Doing So Long. I don't know if you know that book.
I do.
But Andrew Lee at the beginning, I would say, was kind of influential. And then I would say I had 10 years where I couldn't find any books that were really, all that super helpful beyond the winemaking I was learning directly from winemakers. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I just wanted to make things taste better. And it seemed like the way to do that was to actually pull back on everything that I had quote unquote learned, like not pitch yeast, not use much SO2, things like that, which at the beginning, those are the things that can help you make a quality product. Mm-hmm. But once you can control variables, like know you're having really high quality fruit, know that you're having the acid where you want it, things like that, then you can pull back and not worry about pitching yeast, not worry about using SO2. And you get into this almost like lost on this ocean of wondering what direction you're going and making little discoveries here and there, like, oh yeah, that tasted great and I hardly did anything to that cider. Why did that work out? And various things. Anyway, to come back to the Randall Graham book, there's a essay that he wrote that's in that book, something about how he had to unlearn what he learned when he went to UC Davis. I don't remember the title of that chapter, but I highly recommend that because it confirmed a lot of the little micro discoveries I'd made over 10 years to have him reiterate things like,
that's
like
great.
That.
That's great. Wow. I'm sure he'd appreciate hearing that too. At what point did you find yourself saying, I want to go commercial? Because that's a big leap to go. And you got a lot going on here.
Yeah, it was a big leap. That was probably around 2011, I think. And so I'd been making cider for years, for almost 10 years. And I'd been doing those blind tastings with winemakers and elevating the quality of what we're doing. And then it was a combination of several things, one of which was the winter of 2011, 2012, there was a really hard frost that killed most of the buds on all the wild apples around here and a lot of the orchards. And so in 2012, all the wild trees that I'd been harvesting were empty. There was no fruit on any of the trees. And so I had to find apples elsewhere because I wasn't not going to make cider that year because I developed the cider habit. My wife was really loving cider, which it was great to have a beverage I could drink with her.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
Previously she didn't like beer. She didn't like wine. Those were my two go-to beverages. But she loved cider.
Yay.
And I was taking all these ciders to festivals. And so I bought fruit for the first time to make cider. And I bought fruit from two different places. One was from a farm stand. And I got the apples that the old timers used for cider, like Ida Red, Golden Delicious, nice acid apples. But then I also bought some apples from Cornell, who has a research orchard. And fortunately, they had Tremlett's Bitter and Dabinet and Chisel Jersey and these cider apples, which I'd never heard of. And that next year, when those ciders matured, it totally blew my mind on the difference that those two ciders... When I was using wild apples, all my ciders ended up kind of in the same ballpark of flavor because the wild apples average out to all be pretty similar each year.
Mm-hmm.
But with these farm stand apples compared to the Cornell cider apples, it was night and day. The bittersweet apples made such an incredible cider that was sort of, I mean, definitely a shift where, and also at that point, Eric Schatt was the orchard manager. He still is. And he'd already planted an orchard of these cider apples. And he was, we were sharing some ciders that we made together. And so I was aware that, okay, you could plant your own orchard of these apples and grow your own cider apples. And because I'd been working in the winery tasting rooms already, I just sort of like saw this whole pattern like, okay, you have a vineyard, you have a tasting room, you serve cider to people. It's a thing that you can do. And so all that stuff just started to form, you know, an image. And at that point, my background is actually in ecology, forestry, soils, forest biology.
Okay.
And so I didn't study horticulture, but I understand ecology and how trees grow and how soil works. But when I moved to Ithaca after finishing grad school studying soils, the work that I ended up doing was working on musical instruments because I'd apprenticed with somebody as a hobby, learned how to restore violins.
Wow.
And there was a niche for that in Ithaca. And nothing that was happening at Cornell was interesting to me in the field I was in. So I sort of fell into that work. And so I was not all that happy just working inside all the time on instruments. It was fine, but I like being
meticulous
outside.
Meticulous work, though, isn't it?
Yeah, meticulous work, but I really always wanted a job where I could apply ecology in the field.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the essay I wrote to get into grad school was all about applying ecology in the field. And nothing that I was studying was really taking me in that direction. But when I realized that I could have an orchard, that would get me outside. I would be applying ecology in the field. I could also be creating the cider. A certain amount of creativity is something that I always do, whether I was playing music or, you know, working on instruments. And so the cider making I see as sort of an extension or part of the same flow as playing music, doing things like that. And so by having orchards and working with orchards and also creating cider, it sort of satisfies both of those yearnings that I've had.
So is cider making an art or a science or both? How would you define cider making?
Yeah, it's a creative process.
Well, that's fine, yeah.
Yeah, it could be both, but it's more importantly, it's a creative process. I guess, you know, music could be the same way. Is that a science or an art? I mean, most people would say it's an art, but there's a certain science too.
Is there something that you're trying to do specifically with your ciders? Is there a particular style at South Hill Cider that you like to reach for in this stage when you're making it?
but I say, I just want to make a cider, I'm going to try it.
Right.
I have a feeling you're not like that.
Right. No, I'm not. I'm not thinking so much in terms of styles as really trying to, and it's so cliche to say it, but like to show fruit and what certain fruit can produce. And it in several different ways. Like one is I do several single orchard ciders that you'll have an orchard that was planted for a particular purpose. Like the Stone Fence Farm orchard was planted as a cider orchard. And so it's like one third russets, one third bittersweets, and then the other third is heirlooms like Bramley's Seedling or Aesopus Spitzenberg. And so being able to show what that cider tastes like, because those are the apples that are in it. I really enjoy that. And so I've at least three or four single orchard bottlings that I do. And then the wild fruit, the pack basket ciders I make are all made from wild apples. So being able to take all those wild apples and ferment them and just show this is what wild apples taste like. And then some single varietals. I do a Kingston Black, a Baldwin, and a Porter's Perfection, and a Northern Spy. So that's four single varietals that that I do. And so those varietals dictate the style. So like Northern Spy, I prefer that to be a sparkling cider. It can drink okay as a still cider, but it's much better as a sparkling cider. But Porter's Perfection.
Because? Why that one particularly?
Because of its
sparkling.
Just because of its structure. It doesn't, you know, it has some acid, has a small amount of tannins, but not enough to really stand up and be a substantial still cider. So I prefer that sparkling. I have had some Northern Spy still ciders that are really phenomenal. They were actually done by a winemaker, Ryan Monkman in Canada. I don't know.
Ryan's coming down today. I'm going to be hanging with him.
No way.
He heard I was coming down the Finger Lakes.
He's coming down. Oh, great.
Love Ryan.
So yeah, he's made a
still... I'm sure
still...
he's going to be stopping and seeing you, he mentioned.
Great.
Yeah.
He has made a still Northern Spy, which is phenomenal. He uses oak to do that. I think that probably helps it to stand up.
Yay. It brings tears to my eyes.
Oh, cool. But for me, the way I make Northern Spy is just all stainless steel, and I like doing it sparkling.
Yeah,
and then the
yeah.
Porter's Perfection definitely wanted to be a still cider.
Mm-hmm.
It just had so much structure and flavor, aroma. Mm-hmm. It did not need any bubbles to help it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kingston Black can go either way, depending on the year. For years, Eve's made a still Kingston Black cider, which I loved. And so when I finally got to the point where I could make my first Kingston Black, I assumed it was going to be a still cider. Turns out that year the acid was just a little lower, so it needed a little lift.
Lift up, yeah.
And it's a phenomenal sparkling cider. It's great. So depending on which year, it might, the style for a particular variety might even change depending on the weather that year.
So you have the stainless and you have the barrels. How are you managing the barrels then? In terms of primary fermentation, then you bring them out, or you're using it to condition?
Yeah, it depends on the cider. So I do one cider that is fermented in barrel. It's one called Palm Sur Lee, and that's one that I sort of dreamt up this idea that if you add a cider that was acidic enough and you let it go all the way through ml, that it would still have enough acid to stand up. That's what I would want to do as a cider that just I let go all the way like that. And so I do that, and I do ferment that in French oak barrels, and then I stir the lees for a while, leave it on the lees for
a little bit of batonnage there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a bunch.
And so Sur Lee, just so folks don't know what that means, is the lees is the precipitants, the yeast cells that kind of drop down out of the cider. And you just let it stay on the lees. You let it kind of condition on the lees. Mm-hmm. Anything else you'd like to say about Sur Lees? That's kind of my quick definition.
Yeah, no, that's it. Yeah, the lees are the yeast that falls out of solution. And by stirring them up, you're just putting them in contact with the juice again. Basically, so the cider itself can sort of extract flavor back out of the lees. Because the way I see it is, the yeast is growing and some of the flavors from the juice or cider are ending up in the yeast, And then over time, the yeast goes through autolysis, which basically just means it dies all by itself. And then by stirring the lees, doing the batonnage, you're putting them back in contact with the cider so that once those yeast cells die and start to break down, the cell walls break down, a lot of those compounds that ended up tied up in the yeast become free and they go back into the cider. Mm-hmm. And so it allows it to, it increases the body. It also very much increases the stability of the product. Like some of my ciders, that one and the porters in particular, when you do that, you let them age for a long time before bottling, and then you don't use SO2 or filtration or anything. They already do what they want to do in the barrel. So when you put them in a bottle, they have this inherent stability. So when you open those bottles, they're actually good for a few days. And sometimes they even get better for a day or two with a little bit of oxygen. And so, the barrels really help with that kind of...
So how do you manage that? I'm kind of curious because your barrels are stacked up. And so if you're doing batonnage, how would you get in there? Or is that you're doing
it? There's a really nice tool that I borrowed from one of my winemaker friends, which is a curved, I wish I had it here. We're in the middle of moving from our other cidery. It's hanging on the wall at the other place. It's a stainless steel, about a quarter inch piece of round stainless steel that has an arc to it that's about 3 feet long and has two bunny ears on one end that act as a handle. And on the other end is a stainless steel paddle that looks like a tiny little surfboard that's about six inches around.
Yeah.
And it pivots on the end of the arc. So you can feed the arc into the barrel and the paddle ends up going flat against the bottom of the barrel, and then you use the two bunny ears to move it around. And you can splash the...
So you were able to go up high on your stacked barrels.
Yeah, just climb up on the barrels. And to
swirl it around. Because a typical batonnage is like kind of almost like a rowing motion back and forth. But this one with the handle allows you to go sideways.
It goes sideways back and forth.
What are you, standing on the forklift going up there? Because you're climbing up on barrels.
We usually just climb the barrel rack.
That's pretty good, yeah.
But maybe I'll probably use... I just got that forklift.
Yeah, you're figuring
now
it out.
Now I'll be using the forklift.
Yeah,
do that
no
kind
doubt.
Of stuff.
Yeah, I kind of wonder about that because, you know, it's great to stack barrels. Being at Ryan's cellar that he was at Kenty Winery, they were all on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd be able to, like, stand right over it. Because it's hard to manage barrels up in that stacking. To me, in my mind, I just have one barrel, so what do I know?
Yeah, it is a little more difficult.
Yeah,
especially fixing leaks. But.
Ooh, yeah. How do you fix a leak on a barrel?
It depends how it's leaking and why it's leaking. If it's between coming out between two staves, you can actually use it. And this is another thing where the winemakers around here are so influential. I've learned so much directly from these guys who know how to take barrels. There's a hoop driver, which is a essentially like a metal, kind of like a wedge type tool that you put on the hoop and you hit it with a hammer and it drives the hoop onto the wider part of the barrel. So the hoops, you can tighten the hoops of a barrel by pounding on it with this hoop driver.
And the hoop driver's moving the metal ring that goes around.
It moves the metal ring towards the center of the barrel.
Oh, cool.
So it tightens things up. That's one way. If it's leaking, sometimes if you store your barrels outside for too long at the wrong time of year, you'll get bark boring beetles that are very similar to some of the pests in the orchard. They'll bite little holes in the barrels, and there's tools you can use to just put a little plug in there. It's a woodworking.
It is.
Skill,
it's kind of the
barrels.
Fun part of it, but it does take. I mean, anybody considering that, you know, the romanticism around barrels is. I'm definitely into it, but it's a lot to take on.
Yeah, it's a lot of extra work.
And it's good to know for those of us who are just consuming cider from makers who work with barrels, the amount of labor that goes into a product coming out of a barrel is immense. It takes a lot of nurturing, unlike putting it into stainless or an IBC tank and conditioning that way. Are you importing those? Or
I always get those used because I'm not trying to use the wood to impart tannins or even very much aroma. What I'm using it for is the micro oxidation, and so
I get barrels when they're already 6 or 7 years old. So winemakers consider them neutral. Mm-hmm. For the first year or two, they might impart some oak influence.
Yeah.
But then after that, they don't. But they really help with the evolution of the tannins or oxidation with Pommeau. Mm-hmm. And the Pommes Sur Lee I mentioned earlier, the one that I ferment in barrel, those also are the French oak barrels that I use. But then I use some American oak barrels for the farmhouse cider, which is a cider that I've been selling for a year or two now, but I haven't been bottling it. We just did our first bottling last fall, so a lot of people around here don't know it because most of it's been going down to the city where people really like are into.
Do you have it in your tasting room here?
Not yet, because we don't have labels for them. I just sent them to the printer this morning.
Well, how exciting.
So that one I use American oak barrels for. The staves are much thinner, and so they take on more oxidation. Mm-hmm. And that one's in a style that's a little bit... It's definitely not a cedra. I'm not letting it get that acidic, but it's more made in that style. With wild fermentation, not much SO2, and letting a lot more complex fermentation happen.
You have your tasting room. You now have your facility. So you met some of those goals. What are you looking? What's your long range plan here?
That's a good question. Well, definitely looking to just dig in deeper here and just develop a community around cider here. Have events where people can get outside and, you know, just connect with the environment. We're actually right on the edge of a gorge. Right back there is a gorge, and the Finger Lakes Trail is there. So having people experience cider here, but also be able to just take it out.
Walking out right from your orchard here. And what's the gorge name?
It's called, the brook is called Lick Brook. And so it's the Lick Brook Gorge, I guess.
Get a bottle to go and go for a little hike and bring it along with them and whatnot.
So I guess, you know, developing a community here and digging deeper is one thing, but then also increasing production. I've got these 16-foot ceilings, and eventually we'll be able to have some bigger tanks there. And so hopefully just be able to continue.
Keep on keeping on, right? I mean, I know that's a big question to ask, you know, especially at the stage that you are. But I'm going to ask you one more question, kind of along the same lines, but not. If I was to go into your refrigerator at home, what cider would I find there? What's your go-to? What's your drop-down cider?
I mean, often I'll have tank samples from my own tanks.
That makes a lot of sense.
I bring those home to taste them, to get used to them.
Yeah.
Also for the variety of something new.
Mason jar?
No, they're 750-milliliter bottles, because that's what I have in the cidery, and I'll just throw a cork in it.
Yeah.
And so that keeps it fresh. There is a bottle of Albee Hill in there right now, because...
And that's from Eve's cider.
Eve's. That's definitely one of my favorites. And I don't know. Yeah, can't remember what else. I always have German Pilsners in there. I mean, it's not cider, but like...
That's a good thing to do. It clears your palate.
Keeps these things going.
It's a perfect thing. Have a beer if you're drinking a lot of cider.
Yeah, Yaver, I would say, is top of my list there.
Oh, okay. You are open now for business here. People could come to the tasting room year-round?
Yep, year-round. Right now it's 5 days a week. Over the winter, we might cut back another day or so. But
So call ahead, see if it's open.
Yeah, or just check on Google. Hours updated.
Very good. And if folks can't get to South Hill, on the website they could certainly see where it's available. Well, how about the reach outside of New York besides getting it online? Is there any further
out-of-state distribution yet, but we are right on the cusp. There's a small distributor in California called, I think, Lime Ventures. Redfield, the folks at Redfield, Mike and Olivia.
In Oakland, California,
So they connected me with them, and I'm going to be sending a pallet of cider out there for the first time ever. As soon as I get these new full-bloom bottles labeled.
So does that mean that there'll be some South Hill cider at Oakland?
Yep.
At Redfield Cider Bar?
So that'll be my first out-of-state distribution.
Oh, what a great selection to
really,
send out
really
there. That's
happy
perfect.
About that.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate your time. today, chit-chatting, informing us what you're doing. Going to look forward to hearing what you're doing with the quince as you go forward, because that big box of quince came in from Karen.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, nice chatting with you.
Without a doubt, Steve is already integrating the community aspect into South Hill Cider. Folks are certainly using it as a gathering space. It's a really nice place to go and visit, and he's so welcoming and warm. And while I was there, you heard me mention in this chat Karen and the quince. Well, Karen brought in a big old box of quince for Steve to do some cider making with, so that's really neat because you know how much we love quince.
I think that's pretty cool, Rhea.
Indeed you do, Mr. Quince, right? Of course. All right, everybody's getting on the quince bandwagon. And so that was happening. She also had a small bottle of Nocino. It was a very dark, really super dark liqueur, and it's made out of black walnuts. She talked a bit about that. I actually recorded that piece, and that's on the Cider Chat Patreon page. So that's a good reason to become a patron of Cider Chat, help support the podcast, and get little tidbits like that. So that is up there now. And she was just a lovely person. And, you know, they're, you know, that perfect example of bringing it in, helping the cider makers, and working that community. What I didn't get to really tell you yet was I met Steve prior to this. Well, between the Zydeco night at the tasting room and the actual recording, there was a South Hill Cider pairing, food pairing dinner at the Moakley House that's just right off of the Cornell campus, and I believe it's now owned by Cornell. And I just want to tell you, it was super freaking perfect. It was perfect. I mean... The food was fantastic, how it paired with the cider. And, you know, so what does that mean when you say perfect? Well, I'll tell you what it means to me. It's a experience for your mouth. You just taste it and you know everything is in balance. You don't have to work too hard to, like, discover the flavors. They're just coming at you from all different directions and having a party in your mouth that is in the best way possible. It was a fantastic cider dinner. I got to sit next to Steve, chit-chat with him, and have that kind of first intro. And I was wowed by that dinner. So the Moakley House, it's not really open to the public as far as I know. Maybe it is. So if you're Cornell or Cornell grad or, you know, cruising through, keep an eye out for that. But more specifically, keep an eye out for a cider dinner with South Hill Cider. I know they're going to be doing this more and more, and it is worth your time to do it. I mean, going out to the Finger Lakes, it is worth your time to go out there. We just have a couple episodes here for some of the makers. There are more to be had in that region, which is wonderful. And I do have a couple other episodes that were not necessarily specific with makers, but some little more tidbits if you're visiting this region. So you want to check out episode 196. That's Goat Zen to Cornell, where I was just hanging in the goat barn. And that's a beautiful site, lively run goat farm where they make fantastic cheese. And then also Cornell, the scene there, talking about what you could visit. There's multiple gorges in the area that, you know, they have this sticker called Ithaca is Gorgeous. Nice play on word. And then also I had the honor of speaking with Dr. Gregory Peck. He's the pomologist at Cornell. That's episode 198. It's called Becoming a Pomologist. Had a lovely conversation. I've been dying to, like, sit down and have a chat with him. And there we were, just tucked into his office and meeting his grad students. Very impressed, especially on how he works with his students. Dang, having a mentor like that, that's exactly the kind of teacher you want. I just had so much fun in the Finger Lakes. It was a step into another reality, right? Because anytime we leave home, it's a step away from reality. But that feels so familiar. And I know, yes, it's true, you know, going to a cider scene is just, for me, it's really comfortable to begin with. But there's something about the people there that I really connected with. And it was beautiful, too, to boot. Nothing but good times to be had. On that same thread of good times to be had, I want to put out a reminder to you, Ciderville, that if you would like to go on a cider tour to Normandy, France, and the UK, either or both, it's all good, send me a note. Say, Rhea, you know, in the little heading, cider tour. And let me know that, because I'm looking for a certain complement of people to get me going on setting up that tour for 2020. I've already been in talks with my dear friend Pamela in the French region of the cider making territory there. And we are kind of, you know, rubbing our hands and thinking about it and setting it up. Love to do that. And also the UK. Some folks have already contacted me for both trips, but I'm looking for a certain complement that I need before I go full steam ahead. And probably going to still go full steam ahead, but I'd like to start getting my ducks in a row. And I think you know exactly what I mean by that. So don't delay. Let me know. Just send me a little note. That's all. Hey, yeah, I do want to keep on hearing about that, Rhea. Sounds good. That's all I need. And yes, I know the commercial makers listening to this here podcast already have a long list in the running for 2020 that they're trying to figure out to do. So I get that. I get that. But I do want you to add one more thing to your list, especially if you're a commercial maker who wants to get your product out to the folks who buy your product, get some feedback from them, get a sense of if the price point out there is really meeting the market, and at the same time have an opportunity to maybe win some gold, silver, or bronze, right? It's all good at the New York International Cider Competition that's coming up on February 9th, 2020. So now would be the time before the holidays, before you get a little bit too crazy, and to send your cider in now. You just have to go to nyicidercompetition.com. They are sponsors of this here podcast, and the New York International Cider Competition is one of those sponsors that I like to talk about because I think it's a good idea as a commercial person, as a business person myself. Sometimes it's good to get a little bit of feedback from your peers that aren't necessarily other makers. I can't judge in that competition. Adam Levy won't let me, you know, and I like judging, no doubt. It's kind of fun. But he really wants the folks who are doing it at the retail market who are, you know, they're going to put it on the shelves or bring it into the restaurant to say, hey, you know, this is what works about that price point. This is what works about that category. And this is how it's going to flow out into the market. I think it's a very unique type of competition that way. And I could think it would only provide you good info. So again, it's nyicidercompetition.com. Get your submission in now for the New York City competition happening on February 9th, 2020. This is Rhea Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. Dancing in the street, staring at the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun. There's a reason, there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There's a reason why we drink it like this. There is a reason. We like walking out of the orchard, dancing in the street, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We
Yeah.